Have you ever purchased a new piece of equipment or machinery or even an appliance that you'd never used before and you were intimidated by it? A little scared of that thing. This past Black Friday, I bought a countertop espresso machine. Yes, I am one of those people. That thing scared me. Sat on the kitchen counter for a couple of days, I guess. And then I finally did what every red-blooded American does in this situation. I watched some YouTube videos. See how this thing operates. How does this thing work? And I did it. And I've been doing it. And I've got to say, I can make a pretty solid cappuccino now. Now, the foam art, I can't do the little leaves or the hearts, or I've even seen swans, but I can put a cloud on the top of my espresso drink. We've been talking this weekend about disciples making disciples. And you know, you can talk about things all day long. You can consider them in theory or hypothetically. But until you do it, it can be intimidating. And we can be fearful of it. And man, it would sure help if you could see somebody else do what you're thinking about or considering doing. That's one of the beauties of the New Testament in that it provides us multiple examples of this actually being accomplished. I want to encourage you, if you would, to turn in your New Testaments to John chapter 4. We're going to get there in just a moment. But I do want to take the time to extend my gratitude to Watermill, to the elders, for this invitation to come and spend this weekend with you all. It's been good for me on a lot of levels and for a lot of reasons, and Tanya and I have thoroughly enjoyed our time to be with you. It's done a lot of stuff. I mean, it has renewed some old memories and acquaintances of people that we have known from a long time ago that are now a part of the Watermill congregation. It gave us a chance to have Matt and Sarah and the kids to ourselves. You know, when we see Matt and Sarah, it's in this mass of humanity that is the Deffenbaugh extended family, and so we never get time just to sit down and talk, and they fed us supper last night, and it was a wonderful experience. And it gives me a chance to say thank you to this congregation. We have two with us at Center Hill in Paragould that came from here, Erica Ewing Richardson, and more recently, I guess you would have to say it, Leah Freeze. But they are a marvelous part of our church, and we know where they came from, and we thank you for that. I also want to express my gratitude to Bill for, in particular, the three previous lessons preached from this pulpit on Sunday mornings. I appreciate the things he had to say in those as he made effort to help prepare the congregation for this weekend. And those were some marvelous lessons, starting with the needed good news, going to Isaiah chapter 52 and the beautiful feat of those who bring good news. And then of the need for this timely word of grace, studying out of Colossians chapter 4, verses 2 through 6, that we are good news praying, good news seeing, and good news talking. And then last Sunday, he brought that message from 1 Peter chapter 3, giving the solid reason for the hope that is within us. And so it is this morning then that we come to the fourth chapter of John. As you consider all of the various stories of people coming to Christ, of becoming disciples of Jesus Christ in the New Testament, there are just some things that immediately ought to catch our attention. And one is, there is no cookie-cutter approach to this. There is not one set methodology or system that the Bible shows us. And I know that's kind of disappointing to some people because they want the methodology. They want, okay, I do this, then I do this, then I do this, and I get this. That's not how this works at all. All of those examples have something to offer for us, and we're going to go to one this morning and spend some time. We made several references to it actually yesterday. But in John the fourth chapter, Jesus is traveling. He's on the move, which he often was. This time he is going from Judea. He's been down at Jerusalem and in that area, and he's going back home. Home is in Galilee. It's in the north part of Palestine. And he makes the decision to travel by a rather unorthodox route, and that is to go through Samaria because it lies right in between the two. Now, to be sure, it is the shortest route, but that's not the route that most people took because the social and cultural mores being what they were, Jews and Samaritans, they just avoided each other at every turn. And every opportunity they had, they stayed away. And yet Jesus chose to travel through Samaria. And so as they traveled, he and the disciples, they left early in the morning and they arrive outside a village of Samaria called Sychar. And outside that village was this well. And Jesus is tired and he's hungry. They all are. And so he sits down to rest there at the well and sends the disciples to go into town to get some food for them. And they'll rest a while, they'll eat, and then they'll carry on their journey. But while Jesus is sitting there, a woman approaches that well to draw water. Now, we may not recognize it, but this was an odd thing. The very fact that this woman came to draw water at this time of day, by herself, said something. And Jesus engages that woman in conversation. That is odder still. That's even more odd. Because, as we've already said, Jews, which Jesus was one, and Samaritans, and this woman was one, they don't have anything to do with each other. Jews don't talk to Samaritans. What's more, in that culture, men didn't talk to women. Highly discouraged in a public setting for a man to speak with a woman, even his wife. And here was a Jewish man initiating a conversation with a Samaritan woman. Highly unusual. The conversation begins rather innocently with a request, verse 7. Give me a drink. A very innocent and unassuming request. But she expresses her surprise that he would speak to her and to ask anything of her. And Jesus turns that request into an offer. And in verse 10 of John chapter 4, Jesus says, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. So not just a drink that he offers to her, but he offers to her living water. She questions the validity of his offer. Listen, you don't even have a pot to draw any water from the well. Where in the world are you going to get any kind of water to give to me? And Jesus presses the claim of this water. He says, beginning in verse 14, whoever drinks the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. And she decides she'd like to have some of that water. That sounds pretty good. But at that point, Jesus then turns the conversation. And he says to her, and he does so in a rather uncomfortable direction, go call your husband, verse 16. And the woman truthfully says, I don't have a husband. And then Jesus let her know that he knew that, yes, that was a true statement, but there's more to the story than just that. You've had five. And the man that you're with now, you're not even married to. And she is amazed that this stranger would know such intimate details of her life. And to her, the only possible explanation of that is, sir, you are a prophet. And then she seizes the opportunity to turn this conversation away from her checkered personal life in a religious direction, talking to a prophet. And so she raises a question, a perpetual question that has existed between the Samaritans and the Jews about the proper place of worship. You know, the Samaritans had a very well-developed theology. And it was based on what we would call just a section of the Old Testament. They believed in the law of Moses, but nothing else after that. And so they were accustomed to religious discussions. And so, where do you worship? But instead of taking the bait, as it were, and entering into an argument with this woman, he seizes this opportunity to teach something about worship. And quite honestly, this is the part of John chapter 4 that we traditionally and historically have spent more time with than anything else in this chapter. And that is Jesus' very compelling words about worship beginning in verse 21. Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem you will worship the Father. You worship what you do not know, but we worship what we do know. For salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship Him. We spent a lot of time on that verse. It's a good verse. But this woman knows that she's outgunned in this situation in a theological debate. And so she demurs to the fact that we know there is a coming Messiah. And while you and I may be debating over the right place to worship, that Messiah, he's going to settle it all for us. And Jesus said, I am He. I am the Messiah. Well, it so happens that just about that time, the disciples come back to the well. They get back. They've gotten the food in the village. They come back to the well, and they see Jesus talking to this woman. I mean, they've completed their errand, and now they're ready to eat. And not only are they surprised, but I would suggest to you that they're probably just a bit annoyed at Jesus because there are questions running through their minds. They never verbalize them, but John tells us what the questions were that they were asking in their minds. What do you seek? Like, woman, why are you talking to our master? What are you looking for? And of Jesus, why are you talking to her? And so it is that the woman, once the disciples arrive, turns, leaves her water pot, so she's very excited and she's in a hurry, and she goes back into the village. And there she begins to report to others about who and what she has found at the well on that day. And the people that she speaks to are interested in what she says, and actually more than just interested, and they begin to follow her back out to the well. And while they are coming back out to the well, the disciples urge Jesus, okay, let's eat. We're hungry. We got more traveling to do today. Let's eat and get on with our day. But Jesus begins to teach his disciples that, listen, there are some things more important than eating. Now, you've probably, like me, there have been times when eating was about the only thing I could think about. We've all been in those situations. But Jesus says, I have food that you have no knowledge of. And they're wondering, well, did somebody else bring food he's already eaten? And he said, my food is to do the will of my Father. My priority is not my present physical desire or need. It is to do the will of God. And he calls upon the disciples. He says, lift up your eyes. He says, you know, you say 4 months to the harvest. Lift up your eyes. The fields are white already to the harvest. There was a time when I thought in this situation there must have been fields of grain around the base of Mount Gerizim, and he was calling on them to look at those fields. I don't think that's the case at all anymore. I think Jesus was drawing their attention to this crowd of people who were now following that woman back out to the well. Lift up your eyes and see. And so these people, they come to the well, and they hear Jesus speak. And they find exactly what the woman had told them was true. And they believe on Jesus, and they invite him, would you come into town with us, and would you stay with us? And so instead of carrying on their journey that day as the disciples would have preferred, they go into the village and they stay for 2 days. And those people then say, verse 42, they say to the woman, it is no longer because of what you said that we believe, for we have heard for ourselves and we know that this indeed is the Savior of the world. A marvelous, marvelous account of people becoming believers in Jesus, disciples of Jesus of Nazareth. Now, I think there's some things to be learned here. First of all, I think it's important for us to see that disciple-making happens as life happens. That this wasn't a planned evangelistic campaign. I have been a part of planned evangelistic campaigns. The very purpose of going is to go and preach and study with people, proclaim the gospel, and hopefully people will believe and become followers of Jesus Christ. And there were times that Jesus sent his own 12, in addition to others, out to go and preach. That thing happens as well, but that's not what this was. I mean, they were just traveling. And they encountered a woman in their travels. It wasn't planned. It wasn't anticipated. But it just happened. And I think that's how we have to begin thinking about making disciples, is that, okay, we're going to have a program at Watermill that you can volunteer to become a part of that program. And then through this program, we're going to do things. And we're going to evangelize and we're going to make disciples here in Springfield. There's nothing wrong with that. But the Bible tells us that disciple making happens just as we're going through our daily life. We made mention of this fact yesterday that in the Great Commission, there are a number of translations that instead of translating the words of Jesus as "go make disciples," it is "as you go, make disciples." A second thing to notice here is that sometimes we need to engage the quote-unquote wrong people. This woman was a troubled woman. We know that she had a string of broken relationships in her life. There's something to be said about the fact that she was coming to the well to draw water at noon. First of all, that's not the time you go draw water. You go draw water in the morning because you're going to need water through the morning. Plus, it's a lot cooler in the morning than it is at noon. And she came by herself. Women didn't go to the well from the village by themselves. They went with their friends. This woman came alone. A very likely indication that she may not necessarily have been well thought of by her peers in that town. She's the wrong kind of woman, isn't she? I want you to listen to these words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 9. Beginning in verse 10, "And Jesus reclined at the table in the house, and behold, many tax collectors and sinners," wrong kind of people, "came and were reclining with Jesus and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, 'Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?' But when he heard it, he said, 'Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick.'" Jesus is the great physician. He didn't come to treat people who don't need him or don't think they need him. He came to people whose lives can only be described as sick. Go and learn what this means. Now, when Jesus says, "Go and learn what this means," we better learn what this means. And he quotes a passage that he, by comparison, was rather fond of quoting, because this isn't the only time he did it. "I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." This is sacrifice. This is our offering to God, sacrifice of praise. It's our worship. It's our adoration. But Jesus said, go learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. It is not that God is not interested in sacrifice. He obviously is. He gave this long list and very detailed instruction throughout the law of Moses of how to sacrifice and when to sacrifice and what to sacrifice and who sacrifices. He obviously is interested in it. But that's not what he's most interested in. I will have mercy, not sacrifice. This world is filled with people whose desperate need is mercy. Do you remember the parable that Jesus gave of the tax collector and the publican? That's the same thing. The tax collector and the Pharisee who came to the temple to pray. And the Pharisee stood up to pray. Lord, look at how good I am. Look at all the things I do. And Lord, I'm not like other people. I'm not like that tax collector over there. And then that tax collector prayed. And he bowed, and he wouldn't even lift up his eyes, but he smote his breast and said, Lord, be merciful to me, the sinner. And Jesus said, that man went down to his house justified. God wants us to be merciful. And we are merciful upon those who need mercy. Their lives are a mess. Where are the quote-unquote wrong people? Where are they in my life? What do I do when I encounter them? And what would happen if one of them might just happen to walk in here on a Sunday morning? Number three. We have to learn to engage people. Sometimes when we think about evangelizing and making disciples, we tend to look at people as targets. Okay, here's a person I'm going to work on. Here's a person I'm aiming at. They become an object to us. They're people. People need to be engaged. And Jesus engaged this woman. He talked to her. I had a visit with a young woman who is a very successful entrepreneur. She sells a product, but she also, it's a service oriented thing, and she's just successful with this. And so I asked her, I said, how is it that you do talk to people? She said, listen. Just listen to people. Listen to people, because the longer they talk, they're going, well, she said, they're going to tell you everything. They're going to tell you where they're hurting. They're going to tell you what's missing in their lives. And they're going to confess to you, these aren't her words exactly, but this is what she was saying, they're going to confess to you the things that they have been pursuing in their life to fill a void, and that void is still there. It's still empty. And so until we begin thinking about people, not in terms of, man, have I got something to tell you, but tell me. Tell me about yourself. Tell me about your life. Tell me what you're up to, what you're doing. What are your hopes and dreams? How's that going for you? We've got to engage people, because people do have a need. That's actually number four on my list here. People do have a need. Jesus knew that about this woman. There's a big hole in this woman's life, and that's why she was where she was, when she was there, doing what she was doing. And he also knew about her. She had this huge hole in her life that she was pursuing to fill by all of these relationships, and it just wasn't working. She was going, and Jesus was trying to show her That hole, that void can be filled. But you've been looking in the wrong place. Several years ago, Tanya and I knew this lady in the congregation where I was preaching. And she had a string of broken relationships in her life. And she was talking with Tanya one day about that frustration. And after another failed relationship. And so Tanya just asked her, "Stacy, where are you meeting these guys?" "Well, at the bar." Maybe you're looking in the wrong place. This woman had been looking in the wrong place. And people out here in the world, they're looking in the wrong place. They're looking at a swelled bank account as being the satisfaction that they're looking for in life. The climbing the corporate ladder. The being the best whatever it is they want to be. Golfer, or I like pickleball. Pickleball player, or whatever. That's not where it's at. They have a need. And the only one that can ever fill the needs of purpose and meaning and well-being and joy and happiness and peace in life is the man who was talking to this woman at the well, offering to her living water that would well up within her. Number five, we've got to move along. Sometimes our conversations with people are going to meander. They're going to go different places before you're ever able to get to the point. Jesus started talking to this woman about drinking water. That's where it started, not where it wound up. And the conversations that you have with people may start in a very innocent place, but then they can go different places, like this one went to her personal life, to a religious debate, until finally the identity of Jesus. Don't think, don't expect that as you visit with people that you've got to mention, "Hey, I'd like to have a Bible study with you," within the first 20 seconds of your conversation. Have a conversation. Because sometimes they'll go different places, and then maybe you can finally come to the point of sharing the good news of Jesus Christ. The last thing I want us to notice here has to do with these disciples. Remember, these disciples were the ones whom Jesus called and said, "I will make you fishers of men." And they had just gone into the village to buy food, and they did their job, completed their errand, and they came back to Jesus. And they're all worried about, okay, we've got to get this meal eaten because, you know, we really do need to get on the road, keep moving. And Jesus said, guys, you're worried about food. What is driving you right now is not the priority of the will of God. What's driving you is your own physical hunger and your own prejudices. You want to get out of Samaria. Honestly, and rather frankly, one of the best things that could ever help the evangelistic efforts of any body of God's people is to get the priorities right. If the events of this particular day had followed the priorities and interests and concerns of the disciples, what do you think the outcome would have been? Certainly not that there would have been a body of believers in the village of Sychar. That would have never happened. And so Jesus called on these men, "Lift up your eyes." Have you thought about how often that happens in Scripture, that eyes need to be opened? I think about Elijah the prophet, or Elisha the prophet, when the Syrian armies encamped around him because he had ticked the king off and the king was trying to eliminate him, and they camped around them in the night, and Elisha's servant got up and stepped out of the tent and he saw all of those armies and he went back in and said, "Man, are we in trouble?" And Elisha prayed. You understand this is my paraphrase. That's not a quote. But Elisha prayed to God, "Father, open my servant's eyes." And he stepped back out, and all over those hills were the horses and chariots of fire, the army of God. Open your eyes. Paul prayed concerning the Philippians, or rather the Ephesians, "I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened." Folks, we need to open our eyes. We need to open our eyes and see the people around us whose lives are empty and void. And you know what's true? You know what happens to people when they pursue what they think they need and what they want in ways other than the Lord? Do you remember a parable Jesus taught? We call it the prodigal son. This boy thought he knew what he wanted and how he was going to get what he wanted. And so he pursued that. And you know what happened to him? He's in a pigsty. He's even thinking about eating pig food. That's what happens when people pursue what they think they want. That void, to fill that void and empty in their lives with something other than Jesus Christ. And it ruins lives. He's calling us, His people, His children, to go engage ruined lives. Woman was so excited. She was so excited. She couldn't help but tell her friends, her family, the people of that town, "You've got to see what I have found." I want to tell you, that's the very heart of evangelism. That's the very heart of making disciples. Because when someone is so excited of what they found in Jesus Christ, you can't stop them. You can't. Jesus actually tried, didn't he? You think of the occasions in which he could heal somebody or do something for somebody, and he would specifically tell them, "Now, don't tell people." And every time, he told people. Because they just couldn't keep it in. "Can't you see what this one has done for me? Have you forgotten? Have you forgotten what he has done for you?" Or are you this morning one like that woman, who hasn't yet realized what he is able to do for you? When that woman told her friends, saw what they did, they got up and they went to Jesus. And that's what this part of the service is about, an opportunity in this setting, if you would so choose, to come to Jesus. He's offering you living water. And I guarantee you, you've never had anything like it. If you need to come this morning, we ask that you do it now while we stand and sing.